From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This weekend marks 11 years of continuous broadcasting for State of Belief. It was launched and sustained for almost all of that time by Interfaith Alliance. During a brief but very rocky time, our work received crucial sponsorship from Auburn Seminary in New York City. And since our first show on January 15, 2016, this program has been made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very grateful for that support. We don't ever take it for granted. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, January 15th is the Baha'i World Religion Day. The Hispanic Catholic Christian Blessing of the Animals is on Tuesday. The week of prayer for Christian unity begins on Thursday, which is also the Orthodox Christian Triadion. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
The long sweep of America has been defined by forward motion.
And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do. I think it's a disgrace.
A constant widening of our founding creed to embrace all, and not just some.
Since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
If you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
We all knew change was coming to Washington, D.C. After all, we're less than a week from a presidential inauguration. Still, it was impossible to not notice the contrast between the outgoing and incoming administrations. And I'm looking forward to hearing the thoughts on all this from a keen observer of American politics, Greg LaBelle, on this week's show.
Do you feel like in this election we just pray about it and give it to God and God's going to pick the right candidate? Or, you know, how do we go into this as a Christian?
To still go to the polls.
For several decades, at least, the religious political right has been successfully branding the GOP as God's own party. 81% of white evangelicals voting for the unusual Republican presidential candidate in 2016 is just the latest example. But while many feel the Democrats need to work harder to appeal to religious voters, an articulate contrarian voice belongs to Pastor Dan Schultz. His recent Religion Dispatches magazine article is headlined, "Why Being Faith-Friendly Isn't Worth It for Democrats." And he'll be with us to discuss it later in the hour. But first,
we're really hoping that we can build up a network of safe spaces around the globe where kids who are kicked out of their families or excommunicated from their communities of faith or can't go to school anymore because of their gender identity or expression or their sexual orientation can find safe space.
Every January for many years now, it's been my pleasure to get an update on the essential ministry of the Global Justice Institute, launched by the Metropolitan Community Church and headed by the Reverend Elder Pat Bumgardner. I particularly love it when we're able to sit down face-to-face in New York City, where she continues to serve as senior pastor at the MCC congregation in Manhattan. But even when our schedules require us to settle for speaking by phone, it's still always inspiring and humbling to hear about the ambitious work of this unique organization. And so once again, Reverend Pat, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, and thank you for doing this, Walton.
What have been the areas of focus for the Global Justice Institute in this past year?
Well, this past year, we've focused largely on Honduras, Cuba, and Kenya. And we've also restructured our public policy efforts. For the very first time, we got involved in Honduras with an invitation from a couple of groups there, and particularly worked with a women's rights group called Ecumenicas, which is, as the name betrays, an ecumenical group of women who are working for not only health care rights for women and women's right to choose, but also crossing some very important boundaries, I think, around what women's rights include by working with the transgender community in Honduras. And so I spent about a week there, and we were able to initiate a partnership. It's a very minor partnership initially, in the sense that we provided security vests for the women because, as you can imagine, Honduras is kind of a tricky country to be a human rights worker in. And if people can be identified as in some official capacity, it it provides a nominal amount of safety for them in communities that might otherwise react adversely to their presence. And I think it laid the foundation for work coming up this year. The Organization of American States will meet in the Dominican Republic in 2017, and we're preparing to offer training to Ecumenicas to be a representative and speak on behalf of the Global Justice Institute as a voice of faith promoting LGBT rights. As you can probably imagine, most voices of faith that show up at those kind of meetings are in opposition to anything that might be construed as human rights or human equality. So I'm kind of excited about that. And we had our first trip to Cuba. We have a small community in Matanzas, and I spent about a week there, and I think laid the groundwork for a partnership. It looks like we will be able to actually purchase property in Matanzas through Global Justice and private partnership. And that community there is focused heavily on, again, transgender rights and protections, and also work around HIV and AIDS. And the most exciting thing, I think, about Cuba was that during International Human Rights Day on December 10th, the Matanzas group opened another community in Havana, and we were able to be present at that and help kick that off. So I'm very excited about Cuba and what the future might hold there. In Kenya, we made tremendous progress. I think when I was with you last, I told you that we had built a building and were working on running water to our land in the Tetuan Day so that it could become productive for vegetables and crops for people in the area. And the efforts to run water were successful. We've completed the second building on that property and are working on a third that will serve as a classroom for community meetings and children's programs. We held the first ever meeting of sex workers in the area to talk about using our land as an alternative means of support. And we also sponsored the first gay pastors retreat ever in Kenya, at which 10 people showed up and came out. And out of that meeting, a man stood up who wants to help us move into Western Kenya. So I'm very, very excited about that. We restructured our public policy efforts to incorporate them more fully under the Global Justice Institute and to have a broader global kind of purview on that work. As you know, the promotion of LGBTI rights abroad was really a very important part of President Obama's foreign policy work in his during his second term. And as you also might guess, we're a little bit fearful about what's going to happen with those kind of efforts in the new administration. So that's, in a nutshell, kind of the things we've been working on this.
Well, that's a lot. Pat, is there a particularly important recent achievement that you're most proud of?
Well, I have to be careful what I'm most proud of. You know, I don't want anyone to think I'm less proud of them. Right. But I think I'm really, really moved by the efforts of the Reverend Michael Kamindu in Kenya. I don't know if I ever told you this, but Michael was an Anglican priest with a commission in the Kenyan Navy, and he happens to be a heterosexual man married with children who just, you know, felt moved by the Spirit to really advocate for LGBT rights as human rights. And he lost his position in the Anglican Church. He lost his commission in the Kenyan Navy. I mean, in a very real sense, he sacrificed a lot to do this work. And what he's done in Metito Ande, in my opinion, is nothing short of a miracle in terms of really grasping what it means to say queer rights are human rights and working for people to be able to find ways to support themselves and their households and reaching out to pastors, especially gay pastors who work in essence undercover, and giving them safe space on our land and saying, you know, if you want to make a different choice, we will support you, we'll help you in this work. I think he's a real hero of the faith.
Mm-hmm. You know, Pat, you've had been working with so many different communities in so many different places for a long time now. I'm curious, how has the situation, the communities you serve, been changing in recent years?
Well, I think that's a really important question, Welton, and I want to answer it in two different ways. In one sense, there's been a phenomenal global shift in the past 7, 8, 9, 10 years, in the sense that, as I said, queer rights as human rights has actually become an agenda item. You know, if you think about things that have happened at the United Nations and two resolutions being passed around human rights, if you think about the United Nations actually making a statement when the Pulse massacre occurred, you know, first time in history that happened. If you think about the United States and China in 2015 co-hosting the first ever UN Security Council meeting on LGBT-specific issues, I mean, there's been tremendous movement around LGBT rights, and there's been tremendous backlash because of that. The more visible and out and vocal people are, the more bad things that also happen. So I don't want to downplay that. But what I want to say up against that is I think many of us harbor, I would say, great anxiety
mm-hmm.
about what the world movement toward the right and alt-right means, mm-hmm. Not only for LGBT people, but for everyone who is marginalized or struggling to claim their rightful place in this world. So mm-hmm. I think it's a combination of things there.
Pat, where do you expect to direct the most of your energy and effort in 2017? And I guess with that, I'm curious as to what you think is the single most urgent area of concern right now.
Well, I think that's a very, I hate to admit this, but a very puzzling question to me right now, because mm-hmm. the elections in the United States have repositioned U.S.-based activists in terms of where our energy is going to be directed. I think we were entering an era where U.S.-based activists were able to focus more of their resources and time and energy in a broader context and to work on the connections that we share around the world. And I'm not quite sure what to expect in this upcoming administration and mm-hmm. what to think about. Having said that, for me, I think I'll not only continue to be vigilant about what happens here in the United States and how that affects people around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think places like Central and South America are going to be very critical because of the violence that happens there. Cuba is going to be a very critical place because we want to keep the door open there. I think I will continue focusing in Kenya because so many doors are opening there. So I think I'm going to push really hard on the efforts that we've started. And, of course, we do a little bit of asylum work, mm-hmm. trying to help people who manage to make it to the United States. And I'm, of course, I expect those kind of requests for help to increase.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I know there are listeners to this show who will want to learn more about and support the work of the Global Justice Institute. So tell all of us how we can follow your work and how we can become a part of that work.
You can go to our newly revised website at www.globaljusticeinstitute.org, or you can contact us at 446 West 36th Street, New York, New York, 10018, and our phone number is 212-629-7440. Or if you want to just communicate with me personally, you can write to me at revpat@globaljusticeinstitute.org.
The Reverend Elder Pat Bumgardner is a longtime ordained leader in the Metropolitan Community Church and senior pastor of the New York City congregation. She's also the executive director of the Global Justice Institute. Pat, the time always goes way too fast when we get together, but I always appreciate starting the year with a conversation with you. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio again. I am amazed at the schedule you keep and the amount of good that you can do with your energy. Thank you again, and we'll talk soon. And if something comes up in the meantime that you want us to talk about, let us know.
All right. Thanks so much, Weldon, and God bless you for your work.
God bless you. Thank you. Last month, my good friend Greg LaBelle turned another page in an illustrious career as he retired from the position of assistant professor of political management at George Washington University. Greg was smart enough to do this at a young enough age to allow him many, many more chapters still to come. And so, with sincere congratulations on his hard-earned retirement, I'm delighted to welcome Greg LaBelle back to State of Belief Radio. Hello, Greg.
Thanks, Weldon. It's nice to talk to you again.
So I realize recent political events have hit you particularly hard, and I share a lot of that. We both have, I fear, an idealized notion of American democracy that is rather hard to see right now.
I think that pretty nicely sums it up. Yes, yes. Idealism is something that I think has been given short shrift, certainly in the last few months. And I think those who listened to the president's final address from Chicago last week heard, I think, the best of idealism in this country and the important role that idealism plays in who we are and where we go. And I think there was a clear warning in that speech to us to hold on to our idealism, to our ideals, to who we are in the face of some unique challenges that we all think we'll be facing in the coming months and years.
What were your thoughts as you watched President Obama's farewell speech this week?
Well, emotionally, I don't often post a lot of stuff on Facebook, but I did post the speech, and my comment was not a dry eye in this house. Mm-hmm. Seeing him go is difficult. Would have been anyway, but I think made more difficult when one looks at the results of the election in November. I thought it was one of his best speeches in that he really did summarize, I think, in ways that only Barack Obama can, considering who he is, where he's from, what he's managed to accomplish in 8 years, the sense of who we are and what's important about the United States, what American exceptionalism means. He, I think, happily redefined that term in a way that makes sense to me. It's not that we see ourselves as perfect, but we see ourselves as having the ability to change for the better. And I think that's the kind of exceptionalism that that we should continue to work for in this country.
Greg, if you were still teaching, what would you have directed students to pay the most attention to around the end of Mr. Obama's presidency?
Well, I think strategically and tactically, I think that the president and the administration have been working hard to do what they can to shore up some of the successes that we've seen by taking some additional executive action, setting aside some additional land for protection for posterity, I think is a perfect example of that. I think that the president continues to use his powers wisely in trying to do that. The other thing I think that's important to acknowledge is that I suppose is second only to Hillary Clinton, the most disappointed person in the results of that election is probably Barack Obama. And his statesmanship, his recognition of his constitutional responsibility to ensure a transition that's smooth and positive is something that he has taken very seriously, much to his credit. And in his speech, he acknowledged that he was treated the same way by George W. Bush when he was coming into office. Mm-hmm. And that is one of those pieces of American exceptionalism that I think he was talking about. And I think those are two points that I think students need to be aware of in this otherwise era of suspicion and mistrust.
Greg, we're hearing some real negative criticism regarding President Obama over his handling of the Middle East, his handling of Syria. How do you respond to those critics?
The first place to start, I think, is that there, and I think we see this in a number of cases in the incoming administration, as these folks are beginning to talk more about this, as I've watched Tillerson's hearings this week, mm-hmm. And was sort of struck at the, I think, feigned simplicity of these issues. There seems to be an attempt to basically simplify the situation in the Middle East. You know, as you said, I just retired, which lets you know roughly how old I am, and I remember junior in high school taking a course called Problems of Democracy, and one of the issues we studied with the Middle East, and I told many friends in the past few years that I could probably, if I still had that book from 1966, I could cross out some of the names and write in new names, and you would be able to use the book as a text in high school today. Some of these issues are so intractable, so difficult, and I think what President Obama has tried to do, and he did a brilliant interview with, I think, Greg Easterbrook, I don't remember exactly, in Atlantic Monthly a few months ago, where he talked about the Middle East and about the challenges and about the importance of changing how we as the United States look at these issues and take a longer range view. So while there have been some successes and a number of failures in the Middle East, I think that what the Obama administration has tried to do is sort of move us into a new way of looking at these issues that I think if we could continue in that direction, I think would have long-term benefits. But these issues are so intractable in the Middle East. As I said, they go back many, many, many years, and it's a very difficult situation. But I think it is important to reassess what our role can and should be in that area and probably most other areas of international affairs.
Greg, when you look around, you read The Washington Post, I know every morning, you think about Obama leaving the office and a new administration moving in. In all seriousness, do you feel like you got out just in time, meaning that the way we look at politics and leadership are fundamentally changing?
You are very perceptive, Welton. I have told friends that while I had planned to retire at the end of last year for some time, I have said that not having to step in front of a class starting next week of students to try somehow to explain politics, not only to explain politics, but to express my deep-seated belief in the value and importance of politics in this country, I am sort of relieved that I don't have to do that because, quite honestly, I'm not sure where I would begin at this point. Maybe in a year I will feel differently, but right now I don't. I will continue to do some teaching at George Washington, and one of the programs that I will be teaching in the spring is a program that we do in Pamplona, Spain. A number of students come and study with us for a few weeks. And I'm actually looking forward to that because getting the opportunity to present this and see this through the eyes of students from Western Europe is going to be really instructive for me. And I think it's going to help me sort of sort some of this out as we proceed through the early months of the new administration. So I guess yes and no.
I'm assuming you watched the president-elect's press conference. Thoughts?
Yes. More of the same. This is the thing that is distressing because this is a guy who gives situation ethics a bad name. it's sort of, if you say something nice about me, you're my best friend. If tomorrow you say something that I don't think is nice about me, you're my worst enemy. This is a dangerous mindset for a president of the United States. I think that this whole issue around the intelligence community, which again became very clear during the press conference, is appalling. To liken the intelligence community of the United States to Nazi Germany by an incoming president to be openly hostile, and I would say more than hostile, threatening to a free press in this country. Watching this is breathtaking and appalling. Now, there are those who say once he's inaugurated and his people are in place, this may change. I hope they're right, but there certainly is no evidence to suggest that that's what's going to happen after January 20th.
Should the other reporters have responded in some way, or how would you think that should have been handled?
That's an interesting question. And actually, the CNN reporter who was there indicated afterwards that the next question from an ABC reporter, the ABC reporter apparently picked up the question that he was trying to ask. So in that sense, there was a little bit of cooperation. But you got to wonder how much of a chilling effect this has on the media as they're in these situations. His president-elect has banned news organizations from his events through the course of the election. I think that there's a certain concern on the part of news organizations that that could happen again. How does one sort of take that on and deal with it? I also wonder if there wasn't a certain amount of disbelief in that exchange among the rest of the people in the media. I think the third factor in this is that obviously CNN had broken this story, and there is that that underlying competition among news organizations.
Yeah.
And maybe others were thinking, well, finally we'll get our chance. But I think there are a number of reasons why it was difficult and unlikely that other members of the representative media would stand up and take on Trump in that situation. He was very much in control. This is the other thing. I mean, he didn't show any rustiness after 6 months hiatus in doing doing press conferences. Mm-hmm. He came out, he was in control, and I think being in that room, that has an impact on how you approach him and the questions you ask.
I'd like to hear just some of your brief thoughts about the multiple confirmation hearings that we've been subjected to this past week.
The Tillerson one was interesting in many ways. I think partly because this is a guy who's no political experience but has traveled the world as a businessman with ExxonMobil for a very long time. And I think the most interesting exchange was between him and Senator Marco Rubio, who really took him on questions of human rights. And Tillerson was studious in not acknowledging bad actors in the area of human rights in the face of Rubio's questions. Rubio actually came back later and tried to clarify some of those answers, and I think left very displeased with the results. Is this the result of what Tillerson believes? Is this the result of what Tillerson was told he should say by his handlers, which is probably the case? Was it the right approach for him in this group? We shall see. I think he'll probably be confirmed, but I think that someone's going to have to do a lot of work with, at least with Marco Rubio, to get a yes vote out of him. And I think that the same can be said for the others. Mm-hmm. There is, I'm not sure, but I think the approach seems to be even more than usual. Don't say anything because we really don't know where this president is on these issues. And I think that really points to one of the most fascinating aspects of where we are right now, in that I think that transition staff, soon to be White House staff, I think Republican leadership in the House and Senate, and individual members, and probably even men and women who are thinking about running as Republicans in 2018, are sort of trying to figure out behind the scenes, where is all of this going to go? And I don't think we have any clarity on that yet. In fact, that's the word that Rubio kept using with his second round of questions. I need some clarity. Who is this guy? What does he really believe? And now that there is some evidence that the Russians have some dirt on him, will he suddenly turn against the Russians, as he has done back and forth with other political players, James Comey being one of them, over the course of the election cycle? We don't know.
Are you going to keep your eye on this whole situation and try to figure out what's going on as we move through it? Or are you going to spend the next few years on a tropical island somewhere?
I will tell you this. I am spending inauguration weekend at the beach. Several of us have decided we really don't even want to be in this city for this event. Once that's over, I expect to be involved. I'm looking at engagement in a couple of organizations that I think can have a positive impact on where we go. They really address the issue that again, President Obama was talking about engagement, about staying engaged, speaking up, keeping an eye on things, and making our wills known. And I'm going to be looking at a couple of things like that. I've told people as I approach my retirement, I don't own a fishing rod and I don't play golf. So I've got to find something to do. And I think it will be some of my time devoted to helping or encouraging Americans to seriously look at issues and try to come to a better understanding of what the implications of these things can be for us as a nation.
Greg LaBelle is an expert observer of American politics and culture. He's just retired as assistant professor of political management at George Washington University, though I'm glad to know he's going to be doing some teaching there still. Greg has also worked inside several presidential campaigns. Greg, I want you to enjoy your new freedom. Thanks so much for giving us part of your time today on State of Belief. You've always been generous, and we'll continue to turn to you for the wisdom that you have. Thank you.
Thanks, Welton.
It's a provocative Religion Dispatches article headlined, "Why Being Faith-Friendly Isn't Worth It for Democrats." And Pastor Dan Schultz, in reading your words, I felt the fire with which you're writing. How do you define faith-friendly for the purposes of this article?
It's a definition that has come around from operatives within the Democratic Party. And what it really seems to mean is to appeal to social conservatives, particularly white social conservatives, to make them feel like they can maintain their policies or their stances against abortion, against marriage equality, and still be part of the Democratic Party. So essentially, being faith-friendly means agreeing to disagree on those issues with social conservatives.
Make the argument that you make, that you've been making for so long.
Look, there's really nothing wrong with faith outreach itself. Faith groups make discrete demographics, and each with their own concerns. And it's okay to reach out to those people along those concerns and speak to Catholics or to Protestants or to Black Protestants. And we should absolutely, along the way, reach out as well to secular voters. I mean, I'm sure you're going to be talking about Jeff Sessions. And it's absolutely okay to reach out to secular people and say, you know, this stuff is not okay. I'm even willing to say that Dems should do a better job of reaching out on faith issues. The problem is with that branding, the party faith-friendly, it has the potential to really undermine positions that have broad approval within the party on things like reproductive rights, on things like marriage equality. It has a real potential to alienate secular voters who don't want to mix religion and politics, who think that's dangerous. And third, there's no evidence. There's just no good evidence that it works. You know, I've heard the argument this time around that, you know, well, maybe it could have won Wisconsin if we'd only reached out to people of faith. But there's better evidence to show that there was what they call the Comey effect with James Comey's letter to Congress on supposed emails that they'd found related to Hillary Clinton. There's pretty good evidence that that kept Democrats home on Election Day and caused swing voters to move against Clinton in the election. So with good evidence that other things motivate voters, and social issues tend to be pretty low on the list of voter priorities, with that kind of evidence, why do you want to put this particular emphasis on reaching out to social conservatives? What's really the point of that? That's my argument in a nutshell. Can you show me why that would be preferable to going on issues of economics or racial justice that we know people care about?
We know there are some voters for whom values matter. So how do progressive candidates connect with a broader segment of voters around shared values? Because again and again, surveys show it's the labels that isolate us from each other as Americans. We share a remarkably long list of values.
We don't have to put that religious label on the positions. I really don't see any evidence, and I'm talking about hard voter data, that shows the Democrats care about that. Another way of putting it is to recognize that we have what someone calls the left left rather than the religious left. We have secular voters. We have virtually every minority religious voter in the U.S. There are already Christians in the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. Why aren't we trying to reach out to social justice-minded mainline Protestants? That could have been enough to swing the election in places like Wisconsin or Michigan, where we have those people, and white evangelicals not so much. The evidence that we've seen over the past few election cycles is that it's incredibly important to turn out your own base. My argument is that the Democratic base doesn't really care if you say, well, as a Christian, I believe in this, or as a Jew, I believe in that. That's not a motivator for them.
Well, you point, very helpfully, you point to young people leaving organized religion because it's too political for them. So it's the worst of all possible worlds, isn't it? Politicizing religion hurts religion and doesn't even help politics.
Exactly, exactly. You get nothing out of it, and you do potential harm to our religion. Why should I, as an ordained minister, run the risk of alienating the youth in my congregation for the sake of what? Trying to attract white social conservatives who aren't going to vote Democratic on a better or dare?
Right.
This makes just no sense.
Give me an example of what you would say as advice to people interested in winning an election and how to deal with values in an authentic way.
If you want to attract social conservatives, okay, and there is an argument for doing that, because if you can peel off just enough, maybe you can flip a state like Georgia, maybe you can flip a state like Florida, okay? Show me some evidence that that's going to work. Okay. Show a focus group. Show that those are on the list of voter priorities. Mm-hmm. Now, Tom Perriello is running for governor in Virginia. And this will be a really interesting test case. If he is able to attract a significant number of cross voters from that demographic, maybe there's something to it. But if it becomes really what we've seen before with black and white voters dividing along party lines, then no, never mind. Focus on economics. Focus on racial justice. Focus on what's in it for voters' pocketbooks. Really, the best argument that I've seen is that this election turned on white rural voters feeling ignored and taking revenge on the Democratic Party because of it. Mm-hmm. You got to figure out a way to deal with that. And that's not easy, because anything you do to attract them might turn off other voters. That's life.
Yeah.
And that's what people get paid for. Or at least, at the very least, focus on the religious left that we do have, which are those white Catholic voters, the white, liberal, mainline Protestants. How do you get those people out? How do you get secular voters? How do you make sure that the black church voters get out? What are the barriers to those people voting? And what can you do to increase their vote? My guess is that the next election is going to be another base election, and it's going to be a referendum on Trump. So you darn well better figure out how you're going to get your base out and overcome some of the obstacles to them voting that we see in Wisconsin and North Carolina and other places around the country.
Pastor Dan Schultz is a minister in the United Church of Christ serving small congregation in Wisconsin. He writes frequently and incisively on matters of faith and politics. We'll link to your Religion Dispatches article and let you go, but I know we'll be talking with you again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. Keep up the good work, and everybody stay authentic. That's the important thing.
Now, before we go, with today's show, we mark the 11th anniversary of State of Belief. Our archives of past shows contain commentaries and interviews that provide an important history of progressive religion, of the challenges and steps forward in interreligious movements, of stories affirming the value and contributions of people in our nation who hold to no religion but care deeply about religious freedom and our Constitution. We've learned from inquiries posed to Democrats and Republicans, Christians, Jews, and Muslims, and representatives of most all of the minor religions in our nation, right alongside spokespeople from humanist, atheist, and secular organizations, and representatives of the religious right. From day one on this show, we have done our programming with a sharp focus on important goals: to speak with civility and to assure that our guest models civility regardless of the volatility of the subject being discussed, to open our microphone to voices from all religious perspectives, to help our listeners know how to talk about the subjects of grave importance in need of a broad-based public conversation, to affirm the irreplaceable value of religious freedom, and to expose threats to weakening that first freedom in our nation. Among the most difficult shows are those in which I have spoken with people whose words were laced with tears because of needless deaths inflicted by gun violence. We've spoken to individuals from the White House and from war-torn sites of military conflict and from the skirmish for justice that continues among ugly intrusions into Native American communities seeking to preserve their values and their limited freedom. Our goals remain the same, though frankly, achieving those goals seems to be more challenging today than ever before. We've had rough moments that have challenged us, but we never have broadcast fake news. Truth is the sovereign ethical norm of this program, and reality is the stuff of its content. Today, in the stories we cover, it's more difficult to make sure we're dealing with truth, not propaganda. State of Belief is not a politically partisan radio show. Yet we run the risk every week of being called partisan when we simply talk about the highest values related to democracy that have been the foundation of our democracy and for our broadcasts. Affirming the importance of religious freedom and critiquing efforts to compromise it sound to some people like we're biased toward only one political party. Only a few weeks ago, I was in Vienna, Austria, to deliver a speech to the highly regarded Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe. While there, I spent a lot of time with politicians and some clergy from Ukraine. If I report honestly on those conversations and tell you the kind of persecution that people in Ukraine are experiencing because of the Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, some could say that I'm speaking in a manner that disrespects what our president-elect has said about his admiration for the leader of Russia. Unfortunately, it's difficult to separate truth and fiction in the current political environment. The post-truth world of Donald Trump may have been an effective political strategy to win an election, but a proliferation of lies under the guise of hard news does nothing but weaken our trust in government and threaten the integrity essential to democracy. You know, it would be easy for my terrific producer, Ray Kirstein, and me to step back a bit and decide to deal only with non-political, important, but rather easy topics. But that would be a denial of all this show has been and is about. I had a professor who liked to say, "One who is not hurting has no right to tell one who is hurting how loud to holler." operating on that principle, I will not condemn anyone who must step back from the political arena because of what they're feeling. At the same time, I will continue to stress the values you've heard on this show from its beginning. Even though it's difficult, I will encourage those who want to challenge and condemn the policies of the new administration. As I see it, this is not a time for this show to become timid. Just the opposite, really. We're facing a challenge like we've not seen in decades. This is not a time to be quiet, rather a time to protest with civility, articulate opposition in the name of democracy, and to tolerate no compromise of our affirmation and defense of real democracy in which there is justice and freedom and equality for everybody. As we begin our 12th year of airing State of Belief, you can expect the wisdom of the past and the present passion of people unwilling to allow a negation and violation of American values. Please stay tuned. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. As we celebrate 11 years of continuous broadcasting, I want to say a sincere thank you if you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week. We rely on your support to be able to continue this important work, as we have relied on you since the launch of this show on January 15, 2006. As we get ready for our 12th year of continuous broadcasting, we're counting on you now more than ever. And quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else. If you've heard something that you found to be helpful, I urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing it. They may even be inspired to join the conversation that goes on State of Belief. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archives, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned to the show. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Our producer since 2010 is Ray Kirstein. Be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. My guest will include Rabbi Irwin Kula of Clowell in New York City and the author of the new book, Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. Until then, happy anniversary to all of us, and you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, that State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.